Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, see our videos on YouTube, and catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, faculty member at Stanford University's School of Medicine, and widow of Dr. Paul Kalanithi, author of the New York Times bestseller, When Breath Becomes Air. I'm also your moderator for today's program. It's my pleasure to introduce today's guest, my future friend for life, Joyce Maynard, journalist and author of 17 books, including the novel To Die For and the memoir At Home in the World. We're here today to discuss her new memoir, The Best of Us. In 2011, in her late 50s, Joyce met the first true partner she had ever known. She says Jim Barringer asked real questions and gave real answers. He loved to see Joyce shine both in and out of the spotlight, and he didn't mind the mess she made in the kitchen. He was not the husband she imagined, but he quickly became the partner she had always dreamed of. Then, just after their first wedding anniversary, Jim was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. For me, Joyce, reading this was a real gift. As you know, my husband, Stanford neurosurgeon Paul Kalanithi, was 36 when he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. He spent the last 2 years of his life becoming a father and a writer. Last year, I did a book tour on behalf of Paul. I remember during Paul's illness, witnessing his fortitude and just thinking to myself, how can my heart swell and break at the same time? Reading The Best of Us made me feel that way again. Today, I'm pleased we're going to have a conversation about some of the most difficult challenges life can offer and about coming to understand the meaning of love. Please give a warm welcome to Joyce Maynard.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. I have looked forward to this conversation so long, you cannot imagine. I read Paul's book. I couldn't read Paul's book for a while, and I read Paul's book during the very last days of Jim's life. And as I told Lucy before in the green room, I had two tickets for Jim and me to come see you at the Commonwealth Club on what turned out to be the day he died. So this is a long-deferred meeting, mm-hmm. and not the last, I hope. I also want to thank all of you who are here tonight. I see some familiar faces and old friends and other faces I've never seen before who also feel like friends. And I want to congratulate you for being here. This is the kind of conversation that many people feel unable to engage in, and I do not judge them for it. But it is too difficult. I'm sure you have encountered this too, Lucy. It is too difficult for some people to look square in the eye of an experience that all of us in this room will share, perhaps the only experience that we will all share, which is death, and another that we are all very likely to share if we're lucky enough to live long enough, which is that we will lose people we love. So good for you for being there. I believe in shining a light on the difficult topics, and then they become a little less difficult, maybe. I'm going to read a little bit from this book, and then I'm going to get to talking with you, which is what I've been looking forward to so long. I want to tell you a little bit of background about the pages that I'm about to read. And this might shock some people in this room. It wouldn't shock anybody who's a writer, I think. But I've been a writer for 50 years. I've been a writer longer than I've been a parent, longer than I got to be a daughter, longer than I got to be a wife. It's the thing that I have done most consistently all my life, and it is the thing I go back to always. Jim died in the middle of the night on June 16th last year. I was there in the bed next to him. I wasn't really sleeping anymore. I was sort of half sleeping in and out. And I woke up at about 1 in the morning and put my ear to his chest, as I had come to do often during that period, and realized he was gone. And I lay there beside him. I'll be very clear with language, beside his body, because it was no longer fully him, for about an hour. And then I went downstairs and I made a pot of coffee. It was way too early to call anybody, my children, his children, friends. I opened my laptop. That's what I know to do. And I'm going to guess you know that it was no indication of insufficiency of love that I did that. But this is what I wrote that night. On the 4th of July weekend, 3 years ago, at the age of 59, I married the first true partner I had ever known. We spoke our vows on a New Hampshire hillside with friends and children gathered as fireworks exploded over us and a band backed us up for a duet on a John Prine song. That night, we talked about the trips we'd take, the olive trees we would plant, the grandchildren we might share. We would know in our 60s the love we had yearned for in our youth. Each of us had been divorced almost 25 years. How lucky, everyone said, that we had found each other when we did. Not long after our one-year anniversary, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. 19 months later, having shared a struggle that consumed both our lives in equal though different measure, I lay beside him in our bed when he took his last breath. I had once supposed I was done with marriage. A few decades of disappointments and failures had left me reluctant to try again. Then I got married that second time to Jim, but with the belief still that nothing and no man, not even one I dearly loved, could alter my course of fierce and resolute independence. I came and went, always happy to see him when he picked me up off a plane, but happy to hop on the next one that would take me away again. I had my life, he had his. Sometimes we'd share them. That was my idea, though never my husband's. Not until we learned of his illness and we walked the path of that terrible struggle together did I understand what it meant to be a couple, to be a true partner, and to have one. I learned the full meaning of marriage only as mine was drawing to a close. I discovered what love was as mine departed the world. This is our story. And I'm going to read one other section from this book, which is a uniquely San Francisco-based section, so it felt like the right thing to read for you tonight. By the time we get to this point, I'm not giving away anything. You know how the story ends. Jim had received a diagnosis that many people would consider a terminal diagnosis, but we never viewed it that way, as you know. We fought it every step of the way and actually maintained an enormous, almost irrational level of optimism. And we could talk about that, perhaps, where that comes from. But by this time, Jim had undergone 7 rounds of the toughest chemotherapy that there is, probably, 3 rounds of radiation, and a 14-hour surgery called the Whipple procedure, that is basically the only option that exists that might conceivably allow a person diagnosed with this cancer to survive, and probably still they won't. And then the cancer came back. So it was June, Jim's birthday month. We were coming up on the day whose coordinates I had recited 500 times over those last 19 months in one doctor's office or another. Jim's 64th birthday, the age Paul McCartney had written a song about when it seemed so incredibly old. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me? Only 64, I said. Some months before this, when so much still seemed possible that no longer did, I had asked Jim to get us tickets to see Bob Dylan at the Greek Theater. They didn't come cheap, but remembering times when he'd let assignments like this one slide, he bought us two great seats for his birthday weekend. We were well over a year into cancer treatment, and with as much hopefulness as we still possessed, we had also learned that when there's something you really want to do, you shouldn't put it off. Bob Dylan. I think I was 13 years old the first time I heard him. That would have been my sister's Columbia Record Club album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. I fell in love with him then, studying that photograph of Dylan walking down a street in Greenwich Village, holding the arm of a beautiful young woman, looking like two people who would be in love forever, though, of course, they wouldn't. I learned to play Blowin' in the Wind on my guitar. I memorized the lyrics of every song on that album and the ones that came after. Jim and I had loved a lot of music over our five decades of listening. But through all that time, one artist neither of us ever stopped following was Dylan. His music changed a lot, but he was always in the mix with new songs and old songs sung in totally new ways. Somewhere along the line, he turned into this old guy who even sang cabaret songs on occasion, as if he were Frank Sinatra, but more accurately, as if he were Bob Dylan paying homage to Frank Sinatra. My younger self would not have known what to make of this, but Jim and I were older too. Now Dylan was 75, 13 years older than I was, 11 years older than Jim. And he was coming to a wonderful outdoor amphitheater in Berkeley, 20 minutes from our home in Hunsicker Canyon. I'd seen Dylan many times over the years. Jim never had. We'd actually bought tickets to see Dylan one other time a few years back, but that night Jim was called away on some legal work for a client who couldn't wait. Those were the days when we thought we had all the time in the world. And if a job came up that interfered with our plans to be together, we sometimes allowed the job to take precedence, as we would not now. 5 days before the Bob Dylan concert, on hospice now and methadone, Jim started slipping badly, sleeping more, remembering less. His gait, when he walked, was the slowest shuffle, the step of a man for whom lifting a foot off the floor represented an expenditure of strength no longer within his realm. He was barely eating. Even the apple pie I'd made him sat untouched on the counter. His eyes had taken on a look I had not seen before. On the last occasion we'd gone out to a restaurant, lunch in Lafayette, sharing a fish taco and a margarita, I recognized that the people in the restaurant had been staring at us uneasily, as if we no longer belonged in a place like this. You couldn't look at Jim anymore and fail to recognize he was a dying man. As the date of the concert approached, June 9th, a Thursday night, the idea of making a trip to a concert in Berkeley, the idea of making a trip anywhere, seemed impossible. I even went on Craigslist with the thought of selling our tickets or trying to, but I didn't list them for sale. Forgetful as he had become, Jim kept telling the hospice nurses and friends who came by that we were going to see Bob Dylan Thursday night. I'm taking Joyce on a date, he said, though I doubt they believed him. The Greek Theater is an outdoor venue, and even in the middle of the hottest summer days, my husband got so cold now he hardly ever wanted to be outdoors, never mind at night. That morning, though, we agreed we were going to this concert, and Jim rested up all day to be ready. The music wasn't going to start until 8, with an opening act, but knowing how slowly Jim was walking, I knew we'd need lots of time getting there. He dressed up for this. He wore his black jeans with a belt that had a silver buckle and a black turtleneck sweater and black boots and a black hat, a little like the one Walter White wore on Breaking Bad. He looked like some old rock star, a very old one. I wore my special leather jacket with fringe that made me feel like some rock and roll musician's girlfriend, which I was, actually. On the drive over, we talked about what songs we hoped Dylan would play. His choice was Subterranean Homesick Blues. I said Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, though we both agreed that on any given day, we might have made totally different choices. At the parking lot, we got a handicapped parking space, but there was still a significant walk to the amphitheater. With great slowness and some pain, no doubt, he made it, though making it along that three-block stretch of sidewalk took most of an hour. We sat on the concrete then, but with Jim's inflatable pillow under him and blankets, waiting for the show to begin. Only then, Jim's eyes started to close, and he started rocking side to side in a way that had nothing to do with music, because the music hadn't started yet. If I hadn't held him up, he would have flopped over. I brought him to the medical tent. Except for the part about how it breaks your heart, it's not so difficult holding up a 90-pound man. Here was one good thing about having a medical issue at a concert in the San Francisco Bay Area. If it's a rock concert, the people helping you out will be a team of great old hippie RNs. Also, a few young ones from a group called Rock Medicine that grew out of a project the rock promoter Bill Graham started long ago, back in Janis Joplin days, back when the medical issue for people attending concerts was bad LSD trips. These nurses all work for no pay, just love of the music and a belief, as they explained to me that night in the tent, that if at all possible, a person experiencing medical difficulties at a rock concert should receive a little help so he could get back to enjoying the music. Regular hospital nurses, looking at Jim as he was at that moment, would have told me I'd been crazy to bring him here in the first place and instructed me to get him home right away. But the rock medicine nurses were there because they loved music and they believed in the medicinal effects of rock and roll. They had no problem with letting Jim lie on a cot for an hour or so. There were no drugs to help him at this point, but I asked if anyone had a banana, and one was delivered to us, potassium. By this point, the opening act was underway. It was Mavis Staples, another old-timer. From where Jim lay in the tent and I on the floor beside him, I could hear her belting out her songs from the stage while the nurses talked about recent shows they'd seen and others that were coming up. Stevie Winwood, Bonnie Raitt, Joan Baez. One time, Jim opened his eyes and seemed to come to for a moment. "Bob Dylan?" he asked me, sounding even more baffled than the baffled state he inhabited most of the time now. Mavis Staples sounded nothing like Bob Dylan, of course, and even in his confused state, Jim knew that much. He lay there for close to an hour while Mavis performed. At one point, he took a bite of the banana. A few times, I had to put my ear to his chest to make sure he was still breathing. And then he opened his eyes and said he wanted to see the show. "Let's do it," the nurses said. We brought him back into the amphitheater in a wheelchair, which meant they put us in a really great spot reserved for the handicapped, and I wrapped him in all four of our blankets. His head was mostly flopped over, so all you saw of him was his hat sticking out from all the blankets in the wheelchair. It was dark now, and the moon was out, a crescent. The lights on the stage came on. Then there he was. Bob Dylan, wearing a cream-colored dinner jacket and a hat a little like Jim's, but with a broader brim. The band started playing, and they were a very tight band, which I knew Jim would appreciate, my old Jim anyway, and maybe even Jim as he was now. As for Bob Dylan, well, he was Bob Dylan. Nobody else is like him, though I also reflected there was no other fan in the entire amphitheater like the one sitting next to me in his wheelchair. It was late, and normally we'd be in bed asleep by this hour, and the night was cool, even for me. When I asked Jim if he wanted to go home, he said no, in a way that almost sounded angry, but really he was just being firm. my husband wanted to see Bob Dylan. And he wanted to do this with me. And not just for three songs either. About 20 minutes into the show, Bob Dylan started playing Tangled Up in Blue, and Jim said, I want to stand up. So I helped him up, and he held onto the railing. His eyes were looking wild, that look I had been seeing occasionally at this point, as if he were beholding something totally different from the rest of us. He also looked up at the sky a lot, the moon. Sitting there beside him in the handicapped section with my head on his shoulder, I considered the possibility that Jim might die at this Bob Dylan concert. There would be worse ways to go. I kept asking if he wanted to go home, but he was adamant he did not. So, careful as I always was now since the surgery, I wrapped myself around him, and not just with my arms, but my whole body, and whispered in his ear from time to time. We stayed that way the whole show. The rock medicine nurse, Pam, checked up on us every few minutes and brought me coffee. I had been worried about how I'd ever get Jim back to the parking garage, but Pam said she and another one of the nurses would help us. The plan was to let me know when it was the second to last song. When Dylan started playing that one, the two nurses lifted Jim and his chair up to the exit ramp and wheeled us through the crowd. Still wrapped in blankets, with his black hat on, Jim stared straight ahead, as if this was some other planet he was visiting, but only temporarily. We had to go down a very steep hill, which is hard with a wheelchair. If the nurse pushing the wheelchair had lost control, Jim would have crashed right into Bob Dylan's bus. A picture that came to me at this point, in which I imagined Bob Dylan himself in the bus looking out at us with an air of surprise, though in fact he was still on stage. But this nurse was a very large and strong man, so I knew we were in no danger of this happening. We wheeled Jim all the way to the parking garage, which was a long way, and the strongest nurse lifted him into the car, the last strains of blowing in the wind carrying all the way to our parking spot. For a moment there, I considered whether these good people, the hippie nurses, would think less of us when they saw that our car was a BMW, but they weren't the type to judge. Jim said nothing through all this until right at the moment we reached our car. Then he looked up at me and said in a whisper, "Did you have a good time, baby?" The best. After that, no more words. The drive back to Hunziker Canyon took half an hour. I knew it would be very hard when we got home, and it was. I could have called hospice to help us, and they would have come, but I didn't want that. I wanted it to be just the two of us that night. By this time, it was midnight, and I think it probably took me 45 minutes to get Jim out of the car and into the house, and another 45 minutes up the stairs to bed. Then I helped him out of his Bob Dylan jeans and the silver buckle belt and set his hat on the stair railing. He would not be wearing it again. But, as promised, my husband took me to see Bob Dylan that night. He took me out on the town. He was a man, and always had been, who knew how to show the woman he loved a very good time. Now we get to talk.
The details in that passage are so exquisite.
I have to tell
you exquisite.
That our rock medicine nurse is here.
I know. I was going to ask you. You said it.
As are a couple of guys from Jim's band.
Storkzilla.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeah.
In the world of healthcare, we talk a lot about patient-centered care, and that concept of getting people back so they can enjoy the music is maybe the best line I've ever heard about patient-centered care and what that means. So my first question for you is just, how are you? Jim died about 15 months ago, and you've you're grieving in public and you're grieving in private, and I'm just really curious how this all feels for you.
I never cry when I read these. I actually feel happy. I really love to share this. I explained before I started to write this book the day Jim died, and I, so far, my whole life has been focused on telling this story and then now sharing this story, and I feel so lucky. Most people don't get to do that when somebody they love dies. So I haven't known the life after this book yet, but I'm okay. I've had a monumental, oceanic loss, but I didn't lose everything. And I know this must be true for you too. I still know that happened. I know what I experienced, and I carry it with me.
Have you learned anything through this that will teach you about how to care for someone else who's
grieving?
Other than do a book tour after your person dies, which is what I would recommend, and I'm glad you get to do it too.
Yeah. I so believe in telling our stories, and I actually, that belief long predated this experience. I've been, I don't just write memoir, I write novels too, but I have published another memoir 20 years earlier, and I teach memoir, mm-hmm. And that's been my labor of love for about 20 years. And whether or not, it's not about getting people to publish their memoir, or go on Oprah, quit their day job, it is about my profound belief in the power of telling a story. Even if we just tell it so that we have put it down and made sense of it for ourselves and taken the chaos of grief and given some order to it, you know, made some meaning out of it.
Can you expand on that a little more? Because I love something you said in an interview with Paul Costello at Stanford. You said the act of writing is very cathartic in some ways, but you said when you're thinking about the reader, my catharsis is not the reader's problem.
You shouldn't pay $27 for my catharsis,
which is
right?
Great. Right. I'm curious what you feel or think memoir is for, and what was important to you in writing the book, and then what are you giving to the reader in this
book? I'm not
book?
An advice giver, and I know you're not either. I mean, I, you know, the part of that book that is you and the part that was Paul. I'm a believer in, I have been publishing my work for 50 years. It's kind of horrifying, but true. I published my first story in 17 magazine when I was 13, so you can do the math. I love being with Lucy because she could be my daughter. And in fact, I have a daughter just this age, and it's interesting that we are at two completely different life stages with this shared experience. So I've been doing this a very long time.
Yeah.
And what I believe is that I have the most to offer when I presume the least. I don't want to give advice about, you know, what you should do if you get cancer, if you somebody you love gets cancer. I tell my story and make of it what you will, including, boy, I'd never do that. Because that part of this story is some of the crazy things I did. I think a diagnosis like this can be crazy making. And I wanted to capture not just the sort of, you know, heroic Florence Nightingale moments, but all the moments of fragility too. So it's a story. I'm a storyteller, and I believe in the power of a story, and I hugely believe in the perception of a reader to take that story and make of it what they need for their own lives. I'm only half of the process. You're the other half.
Tell us about the title.
The Best of Us. You know, sometimes I really struggle with titles, but that one came to me. I wanted to ask you about your title, actually. That one just came to me. There was one title before that my editor said was too grim, which was To the Bone.
And, ooh, wow.
And it could have been that, too. The Best of Us, of course, is sort of like a play on words in some ways because pancreatic cancer got the best of us. But really, we also located the best of ourselves in this. I'd like to believe that we would have gotten to this place without it, And I say at one point in the book, if only you could learn the lessons of cancer without cancer. And that's part of the function of this book. Maybe you can. But we did become our best selves, both of us. Mm-hmm. And we certainly, the moment, the period, the 19 months that we were fighting that cancer and trying to save Jim's life, although we didn't save Jim's life, we did get to a place together that we had not known before. I know you, mm-hmm. we share this, I think, that we were in some difficulties in our relationship at the point that Jim mm-hmm. was diagnosed. And I know that Paul said that, mm-hmm. and you said that in your story as well. And I totally believe we would have weathered them. We didn't get a chance to do the work that I would have loved to have done. I had a partner that I could do the work with, but we did become our closest and best selves.
I think that quote is wonderful. I wish you could learn the lessons of cancer without having cancer.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Can you tell us more about what you learned about being a partner? Because you're a really different person, or you became a really different person in a relationship, right?
I knew all about sacrifice for children. That was uh-huh. that wasn't hard for me. I'd raised three children. They're long grown, gone into the world, but I could always do that. I'd been a single parent for most of the years that I raised my three children. But I didn't really know about sacrifice for a partner. I don't even consider it sacrifice. I didn't know about teamwork, I guess I'll go. I always called myself a solo operator. I was singularly independent. I had to be. You know, I lost my parents young. My first marriage ended young. If I hadn't been independent, I would have been in big trouble. I knew how to do that. And I was still being that person when I met Jim, and I wasn't going to yield that.
It didn't even occur to you, right?
Didn't occur to me. No. I had, you know, And I also had an absolute work ethic. I got up in the morning and I did my work, and nothing got in the way of that. And it's lucky I had that work ethic. I needed to have that work ethic. But then Jim got this diagnosis. When he did, I was the morning that we went off to get this news, and I was thinking, oh God, let it not be gallstones.
Right. We'd have to have a surgery. That would be
yeah. That morning, I was about 90% done with a novel that was sitting on my desk. By the time I got back to my desk, there was a thick layer of mold on my coffee cup because I hadn't touched my work, and I didn't know I was capable of that. And it wasn't as if I even made a conscious decision. I spoke of how saying the word wife was very difficult for me. Saying the word husband, husband. It didn't trip off the tongue, even after I was married. And suddenly I found myself saying things like, we're on Fulfirinox. We're getting the Whipple. Where did that come from? I don't know. But suddenly I recognized I was part of a unit that was greater than me.
I want to ask you about that. And I feel really, I feel real familiarity with that. You know, talking about his treatment in the plural and all that stuff. And you were his wife, and then you became Jim's medical advocate and caregiver. And you wrote some blistering stuff about that, about your own ambivalence and pain around that, and the fact that you were a writer who wasn't writing. And I get that you're, in a way, you were putting it on hold, but it was like you were completely engrossed in what was happening. But I love how you put some of that stuff into words, and I think a lot of people did, and there's 40 million people.
And some people really didn't. That really bothered some people, and that's
part
of my
thing, right?
Yeah. I didn't write for 19 months. This was unprecedented in my life, except on Facebook. I published one column in the New York Times, but other than that, I didn't write. But Facebook became very important to me. It was my connection with readers, and I've been connected to readers for all my adult life and then some. So I wrote a piece at one day about just the frustrations that I sometimes felt. Just that, where did my life go? And I did it because I needed to express this, but I also wanted some man or woman out there who was living that life to feel less alone. And to have that frustration acknowledged. And, you know, there was nobody who understood that better than Jim. It afflicted Jim. Jim would sometimes say, this wasn't what I wanted for you. This wasn't what I wanted for our life. And as painful as the treatment was, nothing was more painful for him than to watch me not having my life. But this was my life. This was, that was the thing. This became my life. And he said something about 6 weeks before he died. We were at Parnassus Hospital on the 14th floor, which was my home for a long time. And he said, one day you will tell this story, which he always knew I would do and wanted me to do. He saw me taking notes. I always took notes. Some things you don't have to take notes on. You don't have to remember, did you have a good time, baby? That one will stick in the mind. But I wanted to write down the things that I might not remember because I knew I was going to write this story. I wanted desperately for it to have a different ending.
Well, thank you for talking about being a caregiver. And Rosalind Carter said this amazing thing. She said there's four kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who need caregivers. And I'm taking audience questions up here, and one of them, the first one I got was, when are you moving back to Mill Valley? We miss you. And
not moving back.
Another one that you kind of just touched on.
I can
on.
Visit. I love Mill Valley. I mean, I lived on the mountain for a long time. I can go hike on the mountain.
Another question you kind of just touched on was, somebody wrote, what did Jim do to make the process easier for you or help to work through your fear, anxiety, and grief?
Jim allowed me into the most intimate experience that a person can have. You saw that slideshow. I wouldn't have loved him any less if he hadn't been this very handsome, debonair man, this beautifully dressed kind of, you know, romantic character in his, you know, BMW. It was a Porsche, but, you know, we were zipping around having this sort of, you know, life that I'd never had before. I would have loved him if he hadn't been that person, but all of that went. All of that went away. And he allowed me to see him in his most naked and humbled self. And that was a gift. That was a gift. You know, we met on Match.com. I always like to say that because I like to inspire people, you know, who are you know, this age. You know, don't give up. You know, I met a lot of other people on Match.com too, but that I didn't marry. You know, typically on a Match.com date, of which I have had many, over the years, you present your best self, all your, you know, most appealing traits. And we actually didn't even do that. That very first date, before any of this happened, I told him, you know, my biggest failures in life. And he did the same. It was astonishing, actually, but that was nothing to what came. And I feel that that was such a gift that he allowed me, this person that he hadn't even met until 4 years earlier, to share that with him. That was a gift.
I love it.
He was also an incredibly funny person. And he never, ever lost that ability to look at the humor.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, gosh, can I? Probably I'm not going to do a good example. I'm probably not going to come to it. Here he was this... Okay, I will tell you. So when we went on hospice, The biggest fear was sepsis. You know this. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't necessarily die of the cancer, you die of the sepsis. He had, and we had had one terrifying experience of driving in the middle of the night over the Bay Bridge to get to the hospital because his temperature was climbing, and to get the antibiotics. And we got there. I'd had two glasses of wine that night. It was like, there isn't even enough time to call an ambulance. We just have to go. And we got there and we got the antibiotics. And then we had a decision to make. What's going to happen the next time his temperature spikes? Are we going to drive over the Bay Bridge again? And if so, maybe they won't let us go home. And then he'll die in the hospital. So we had made the decision that we were not going to do that anymore. And that's when we went on hospice. That's when we gave up the hope piece. And so now we're sitting with, I likened it to one of those suicide bombers that has, you know, explosives strapped to his chest at any moment. I was taking Jim's temperature, you know, 30 times a day. But for what purpose? If it did spike, we weren't going anywhere. We were just going to say, okay, here we go. And we were there, and this was just during the period when the Warriors were in those playoffs with the Cavaliers the first time round. And we were really invested in those playoffs. I think it was very sort of symbolic for us. And Jim always put on this yellow shirt, and we went over to friend's house to watch the games. The shirt was like, we could have put three of Jim in it. And we were watching one of the games where the Warriors were losing badly. And Jim was coming in and out of consciousness, but he wanted to be there at that game. And he woke up at one point, and Steph Curry was definitely not at his best. He kept on missing baskets. And Jim kind of came to, and he looked at the screen, and he said, Steph Curry's gone septic. There you go.
I want to share something you wrote about that pivot when you entered hospice. You said, this is about when the time came that Jim was told chemotherapy was no longer an option for him. And
he lied, incidentally. My Eagle Scout husband, who never lied, we went to see the oncologist, who I loved.
Oh, yeah.
And he was desperately trying to get one more round of chemotherapy, even though he was in stage four, and there was a time when he knew that stage four meant you were never going to get cured, but he'd kind of forgotten that. And he just wanted to get a clinical trial. He just wanted to get chemotherapy. And Katie said, how are you doing? Dr. Kelly said, how are you doing, Jim? And he said, great.
There's just something about pleasing your oncologist, too. And chemo or no chemo?
He just, really, truly, yes, he yeah. just wanted to, he yeah. just wanted to be a contender. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'm sorry, I interrupted
you. You wrote about that time you said that news, no more chemo, was, quote, harder than any surgical procedure, more brutal than the effects of any chemotherapy infusion. He had lost that last shred of hope, and that had left him in a landscape of desolation more vast than all of the Olancha wilderness. And I'm really curious to know, was there anything else, was there something else other than survival that came to constitute hope during that time?
Wow, that's a profound question.
Or, you know, like, what was Jim's priority during that time? Because previously it had been surviving as long as possible,
yes.
And then it sort of morphs, right?
We didn't, you know, we did not match the, you know, I read Being Mortal during this period, and I was not unacquainted with the concept of, you know, at some point you surrender to this experience. You view life, death, dying as a life experience. I think that's a beautiful idea. It wasn't where Jim was going. And we did not talk about dying, besides his sitting me down one day and telling me who should get each of his cameras and guitars and the passwords. We never discussed it. He basically didn't want to. He was still talking about when the fourth season of House of Cards was going to start. And that was, and you know, how good the tomatoes were going to taste that I was planting, that he wasn't going to be around the election. We won't get to. But that, so you could say that's a less spiritually elevated place. But I don't think so, actually. I think it is maybe what some people need, and he was one, was something to reach for always. I tell the story in the book. And as a physician, I'm sure, you know, this might have given you a laugh. Once there was no more chemo, there was no more anything, no clinical trials possible, Jim counted on me to come up with something. I always had one more thing in my back pocket, and I was always researching, and I didn't have anything more in my back pocket. But I tried to think of, like, what would be a magic potion? What would be like a magic potion? And the first thought that came to me was the breast milk of newly delivered mothers during the first 72 hours, colostrum. There's zero medical research on this topic. I mean, you know, that we did, you know, you can read some things about pomegranate seeds or turmeric, but nothing on colostrum. I just decided that he should have some colostrum. So I had this big Facebook community, and I went on Facebook. I had 5,000 people now following our story, and I said, does anybody have some colostrum? And three women FedExed us colostrum on dry ice. Did I think colostrum was going to save my husband? No. Or cure the infection? No. I wanted to have something to give him. And I have no regret about the efforts made to get that colostrum. And I love that those women did that.
But it wasn't, you're telling it right now in this like buoyant way and we're all relating to it, but at the time it wasn't funny, right?
Like, no, it wasn't funny.
Not at all.
No, it was, we need to be doing mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. We were doing something mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. There's a reference to the Alancha Wilderness and what you read. Jim had loved the Eastern Sierra. It had been a place he'd gone all his life, and he had always wanted to take me, and he never had. Mm-hmm. And he said, "We're going to the Eastern Sierra." He died on June 16th. This was May 10th. We went to the Eastern Sierra. Doctors said, "You're crazy. You know, you could kill him." Well. And incidentally, he took a gun to the Eastern Sierra because he liked to target shoot, and he had a piece of land in the Eastern Sierra. And we went there, and I did briefly. I wasn't even sure he was going to get to this, you know, piece of desert. And we set up the target, and I did have this moment thinking he could do away with all the terrible last part that is ahead, and he knows it. He's got a gun in his hand, but he didn't. He just made three bullseye shots. And we went to see the Mono Lake and did a few other things and had some antibiotic infusions with an IV pole by the side of the road and
amazing.
Went home.
Oh, it's so interesting. It's that's the thing you called the Owens Valley Pilgrimage.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You took some risks. I mean, it's like you were in this sort of battle.
Well, life is risky.
But you made trade-offs. You really made brave trade-offs, you know?
And we made some terrible mistakes, too.
Tell us.
Yeah. You know, this gets to sort of medical particulars. When you have a Whipple procedure, which is this operation where they reconfigure your whole abdomen. Jim said, picture gutting a fish, that's about it. And no organ is in the place that it started out to be. And they take out the tumor and you don't have one meal that works anymore, ever again, basically. But and after you wait for the pathology report to find out, you know, how the lymph nodes looked, and our surgeon came back, our hero surgeon. We traveled, this may have pained you to read, you know, we lived right close to UCSF and Stanford. We traveled 3,000 miles to Boston for this surgery. Why? It was my own magical thinking. If we travel further than most people, maybe we'll have a better result. That's the kind of stuff I did. So we were in Boston, and our hero surgeon came by. We were sitting actually on a bench. It was the first day that Jim had been able to get out of the hospital in his gown, and we're sitting on the bench, and our surgeon comes by, and he's beaming. He said, "This surgery went great. I just got the pathology report. 38 lymph nodes, 36 cancer-free."
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I looked at his face, and he was the doctor. He looked happy, and he had had a very successful experience in this surgery. But after, I thought, wait a second, what about those other two? So I wanted Jim to get right onto chemotherapy as quickly as possible. They told us wait 12 weeks. I thought, my husband is stronger than most people. I want him to start getting chemotherapy sooner. And he's an Eagle Scout. He's tough. And so, and our doctor back in California said, you can start at 8 weeks. Well, he got knocked with C. diff. And antibiotics didn't work. I got online, started researching, found out about fecal transplants. We did that. You know, some people were shocked, not me. And we knocked out the C. diff, but too. And I always mention fecal transplant because it has a bum rap. But you know, it's just I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. What? You know, people are uncomfortable, but it saves people's lives. So I always say that. But anyway, but it was too late. He had been off chemotherapy too long, uh-huh. and he couldn't go back on it. And that probably was uh-huh. that probably was a moment we should have uh-huh. known. But I'm glad we didn't know, actually. I'm glad we didn't know.
I think this was a very interesting book for me to read as a physician. Like, I kept seeing it through all these different eyes.
I really hope physicians find this book.
It gives you some insight. It's helpful.
I wanted to convey what it is like to be a lay person, mm-hmm. you know, not an uneducated lay person, a person, you know, who knows how to research, as did Jim, mm-hmm. you know, go online, but still, who is having to make these decisions at a moment of, you know, the most terrible moment in your life, and you're Googling stuff, mm-hmm. and how on earth are you to know?
Yep.
How on earth are you to know?
Another audience question that you'll have to follow up on later is, will you help me write my Match.com profile?
Oh, I have done it for several people, actually. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that later. Yeah, I would be very good at it.
So I want to ask you about criticism. So you've been criticized.
I will just say, probably don't mention your cats. I don't have any, so.
Speaking of which, you've been criticized for things you've done. You've revealed about yourself. On the first date you met Jim, you talked about your experience adopting two girls from Ethiopia, and then they were rehomed with another family a year later.
We're going to talk about that with 2 minutes left to go, but we will.
No. We don't. Well, you said, so you told him, this is my greatest failure.
Yes.
But then you talked about it in this book yourself.
Yes, I do.
And it led to this backlash on the internet when it happened, and obviously the internet's the yes. meanest place on earth. And then I've heard you say that criticism of whatever, your writing, doesn't rock you the way that it would have in years past. And can you tell us about that and why?
There's no way to tell the story of the adoption swiftly, but I will...
Read the book.
Read the book, yeah. And my editor did urge me, oh, don't tell that story. You know, you'll lose mm. people there. But it was actually... It totally belonged mm-hmm. there mm-hmm. because... just a few years before I met Jim, at the age of 55, having raised mostly as a single parent my three children, launched them into the world, struggled mightily to do that, finally sort of, you know, not under as much stress and difficulty to sort of make that all happen, I made the decision to adopt two older children from Ethiopia, orphaned by AIDS. And I did that. And I went to Ethiopia and I brought them home. I did not have a partner. I was not a wealthy person. I'd sold a book to the movie, so for about 10 minutes I thought that was what I thought was rich. But and I did my research. I read. I took courses. I recognized very early on in that process that that I was not the parent that my two girls needed. And that I was not, everything that I thought I knew about being a parent did not apply here. And I would have completely stayed the course forever had it worked for them. But I also recognized over the 14 months that they were my daughters, that I was profoundly not that person. And I found them a family, which is not a very easy thing to do. I never use the word rehome. I don't fault anybody who uses it, but it's a very sort of sanitized word for a very painful experience. I found them a family. I found them the family that mm-hmm. they needed, which included a father and many other children and a support system that I could not give them. And I said goodbye to them. And at the moment, the reason that that story belonged in this book, although my editor said, oh my God, people will hate you, and many have not ever gotten past that. I lost a lot of friends, and mm-hmm. you can still find things about me on the internet about this. As a verb, it's to Maynard children, which means
it's amazing.
Give them up. I didn't give them up. But that story belonged in this story because the woman that I was that night that I sat across a table at a restaurant in Marin County having that first date with Jim, and I told him that story, believe it or not, not usual match.com material, I had just experienced this, the biggest failure of my life, and a failure at love, I felt. I had not been able to love tenaciously enough to stay the course. And so really there was a redemption, not the one, again, that I would have chosen, in discovering that I did mm-hmm. stay the course. I could stay the course for the person who needed me, for whom I was the right person. So I tell that story in the book. But it is a difficult story. It's not a story that you can tell in a soundbite. And I tell it for the first time ever in this book. And even then, there are parts of it I can never tell because there are two children involved. But I tell my part of it.
You just touched on the word rehome, and I want to ask you about another word, which is, I've heard you don't like the word widow, and I actually love it.
I was so interested.
Wow.
It's dark. And you're
sort
so
of
young.
Historically stigmatized, and it just sounds awful, and I feel like that's sort of what it felt like to me initially. It sort of felt good to say it very plainly. So I'm curious, why do you hate it, and then what would you say instead? How would you describe yourself?
Well, I'm going to think about that now, Lucy. Maybe it's a little bit of residue from originally I couldn't say wife either. Uh-huh. You know, I seem to have this problem. Got over that one. It just sounds sort of pathetic. You're not pathetic. I'm not pathetic. Maybe it's not pathetic. Maybe we have to show that
I'm in a Facebook group.
We are role models
Hot Young Widows Club.
Strong, you know, widows. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right. I'm going to work on that one. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
So there's a couple of questions about movies and people who really loved To Die For.
Are we ever changing course?
Curious about what if somebody would want to make a movie of this book, would you do it?
They'd have to be a really, really handsome actor, really charming actor to play Jim, and then he'd have to be willing to go on a big diet for the last scenes. Sure. Right. I think it's a really romantic story.
Me too.
And I don't think we have enough real life love stories, you know, that are grounded on, you know, true stuff mm-hmm. and mature people and mature love. Yeah, I'd love it. Yeah.
He could Hollywood's be listening.
George Clooney could do Jim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have this odd little quirk that I start my day. The first thing I do usually is I check the news and I find out like what our president has done today. And then I go on, I won't even say our president, what's some people's president. And then I listen to Stephen Colbert, who reminds me of Jim.
Oh.
And it's sort of like I can imagine because he's funny and he's debonair. And so then I get to hear Stephen Colbert. That's my little... Do you have little like things, odd things you do to like summon up Paul?
You watch Colbert to summon up Jim?
I do.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
He had a similar hair really on.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Somebody just asked who would play you?
Oh, who would play me? Oh. Those are the two I always hear.
Really?
Yeah. I haven't thought
Susan
about that.
Susan Sarandon Goldie Hawn.
Yeah.
We'll help you.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. You and Jim had a whole bunch of favorite poems and favorite songs, and you introduced me to that poem, Happiness, by Jane Kenyon, which is about how happiness finds you again.
Yes.
And the Book of Love, which was part of Jim's memorial, and it was the soundtrack to this gorgeous slideshow that's on your author website.
And incidentally, there is a 4.5-hour soundtrack on my website if you like want more.
Like it's like a playlist.
It's a Spotify mm-hmm. playlist of like if mm-hmm. Jim had made the playlist mm-hmm. it would have been very different. It would have had a lot more Led Zeppelin, but it's a mm-hmm. just heartbreak playlist mm-hmm. basically.
So you wrote, there is a history of secrets a couple shares. What happens to those secrets when the only other person who knows them beside yourself ceases to exist? So what's the answer to that? Or maybe the answer is you put them in a beautiful memoir.
Well, I did that. Yeah. And sometimes I think you just carry them with you, mm-hmm. and you manifest the lessons, and then they're mm-hmm. there. I think one of them is to live boldly, everybody can see that if somebody is at risk of sepsis and they've got infection rampant through their liver, that going to the Owens Valley is not safe. But the truth is, nobody here in this room is safe. We are never mm-hmm. safe. And we just have to plunge in anyway. And I find myself plunging in more because mm-hmm. Jim doesn't get to plunge in anymore. And so I just want to plunge. I want to, you know, there are worse things than feeling pain. Somebody said I couldn't read this book because it would make me too sad. I don't think feeling deeply is the worst thing. Feeling nothing is a sadder thing for me. Mm-hmm. I want to feel. I wonder if this is true for you, I sometimes miss the intensity mm-hmm. of yeah. feeling. Mm-hmm. We were so, mm-hmm. so,
a like friend fused. That I was just,
we yeah. were just so in that moment at that point. And it's very hard to maintain that, but I miss that.
Totally. It's funny. I think, is the end of the book like you are literally diving into water? Isn't that?
It is.
Plunge.
Yeah, I swim.
People are curious to know if you're willing to share what you did with your wedding ring and Jim's wedding ring, and or if you're willing to share last things that you said to each other.
Well, sure, of course I'll share that. The last things I'll say, it's not like in the movies. You probably know this. If a person is on morphine, they're gone for quite a while before they're gone. So I choose to think of what Jim said that night at the Bob Dylan concert as the last thing he really said to me. He kind mm-hmm. of drifted mm-hmm. in and out after that. Our wedding rings... Jim had given me a diamond ring. I'm so not a diamond ring person. And I loved it. And my daughter looked at that ring. She said, "What? Who is this person?" But I came to love that diamond ring because it was Jim, and he was a very traditional guy in lots of ways. Then I had just a plain gold band. The diamond ring was actually an engagement ring, and it was so expensive. I said, "Please don't buy any more of these rings. Enough." So I just had this, cheaper, simple ring. Jim had one too, and Jim got so thin that at some point the ring fell off, and he was so distracted by this that he couldn't find his ring, and that he had to go get another ring. Mm-hmm. And he would say every day, "We're going to go into San Francisco. We're going to find a ring." And I think about two nights before he died, I slipped my gold band off of my finger and put it onto his finger so he would have mm-hmm. a ring on his finger. And I wore that ring for some time. I don't wear the diamond ring anymore. Mm-hmm. I write something about the diamond ring in the book that I look at it and I hold it up and I see all the little sparkles that it makes, and it makes me think of Jim. But I don't have a husband, and it doesn't feel like. Do you wear your ring?
I have Paul's and my engagement ring on this hand.
Yes,
not mine, but
that's an interesting mm-hmm. thing to do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wear this is a signet ring of Jim's that I wear.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah,
on your middle finger on your left yeah. hand. We've reached the time where we have one more question, and I know you wanted to do a teeny reading.
I want to read a tiny little thing at the end, but I love these questions. These are really great questions.
This is fun.
Yeah, it is.
So your readers have come to know you during these really disparate times of your life for 50 years, and yes. really different things you're writing about. And in my own life, I feel like I've lived multiple lives. 5 years ago, I was a married physician, and now I'm a widow and a solo parent and the type of physician who talks to you on a stage, yes. which I think it might be my dream job. Uh-huh. And I'm curious how you manage those big upheavals in your own identity over the time, your self-concept or your whatever's coming in your life. And I guess tied up in that is, what do you think is next?
I'm a really resilient person. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean I feel any less, but the first time that I was really wiped out mm-hmm. in my life was I was 19 years old, and I didn't think that I could go on at that point. And either you don't, or you learn how to go on. And so I've experienced a few of those over the years, and I know that I will, and that what I choose to do is take all the hard things that have happened, and some people become very damaged and bitter by them, but I hope I've become a better person for them. I know I've become a more compassionate person. I feel that. So I have not a clue. I'm traveling all around the country. It's a crazy book tour. I've never done something like this before and never will again. But not because I don't like it. It's just this story. I'll never have this story again. And when I come home, then I'm going to take my dog for a walk and go for a long swim and say, what's my life now? Because you know.
And come to dinner at my house.
Oh, will I ever? And meet your daughter. My life and your life cannot be an endless memorial to the men that we loved and lost. We're still alive, and it's our responsibility to treasure this precious life we have, this one life that we get. So I
think you're saying really beautifully sort of what resilience is or can be.
Yeah.
Do you want to read
it? I would love
to close up.
So this is a very short passage from the very end of The Best of Us. And I thought it kind of would speak. Well, I'll just read it. Here's what happens when you love someone a great deal and he gets sick and then he dies. All those months you spent taking care of him, it was almost as if the two of you were one person. He was the one with cancer, but the pain consumed you both. You were off in the North Atlantic somewhere, stranded on an iceberg, and though it was brutally cold in that place, and every single thing about being there was hard, you were together on your iceberg. There was hardly one thing that took place that you did not share. Then your iceberg broke in two. You floated off in one direction, he in another. And though the place you ended up is a warmer one, with sailboats passing by, their bright flags fluttering in the breeze, and people waving and calling out to you, sunshine again, and maybe even porpoises circling with their smiling faces, your fellow traveler has disappeared. His iceberg melted away with him on it. New things are happening now that you experience and he does not. Some wonderful, some awful. What would Jim have thought about the election of Donald Trump? That would have killed him, I said to a friend the morning after, if he wasn't dead already. Maybe this is what people mean when they say life goes on. This is the good news and the terrible. It began that summer, this process of drifting off to sea. It doesn't mean you cease loving the person who left. Everything you had and everything that happened remains with you. Life doesn't stop is all. Not yet, anyway.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Can we go out on the road on this?
Yes.
I want to thank Joyce Maynard, journalist, novelist, and author of the new memoir, The Best of Us. Thinking about the words to that song, The Book of Love, your love story was not long. It was certainly not boring. It was gorgeous. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. A reminder for everyone here, copies of The Best of Us are for sale here, and Joyce will be pleased to sign books following the program. I'm Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.